I'm Adam.
And I'm Mike.
Welcome to The Dad Experience, a podcast where dads can connect and openly share stories. On today's episode, we talk to Dr. C, Assistant Professor of Cardiac Surgery from C.S. Mott Children's Hospital in Ann Arbor, about what you need to know as a parent on congenital heart defects and things you can do and get involved with during Heart Awareness Month. All of this, along with our favorite segment, movies you love and are excited to share with your kids. Welcome again back to The Dad Experience. So excited to have you all with us on this great adventure we call fatherhood. Thank you so much for all of our returning listeners, as well as all of our new listeners and subscribers that are joining us for the first time. Welcome, and thank you. We're very honored to have you along with us for this great, exciting adventure. Lots have been going on since our last podcast episode, and things seem to keep getting bigger and better for us here at The Dad Experience. So we're hoping you're liking some of the changes and the new things that have been going on with us, along with our joining of the Parents On Demand network. So without further ado, let's get right into it. Mike, how have things been going since our last episode?
Not too bad. Been enjoying lots of shoveling. Digging myself out of my own driveway from the plows. That's always great.
Yeah, I know. It's been a pretty bear, especially this last weekend, huh? And the boys not have school on Friday, or?
No, they finally called it.
Yeah, and did you guys get the call early or late?
No, they got, we got the call around, I think it was like 7 or 8 o'clock on Thursday.
Yeah, it's about when my school canceled too. So it was nice. We were all home for a nice long weekend, which was nice. But I'm done with snow, I think. I think I'm done with snow. It can go away.
Well, we had that sleet earlier, and it just made everything so heavy.
Right.
Damp.
So
and then gave a nice sheen of ice over everything.
Right. So I'm extremely jealous of anybody that listens to us from warm weather areas, especially in our winter time. So they're very lucky. Very lucky. Although we do get the snow days, and being a teacher, it's not so bad. It's not so bad at all.
Yeah, if they give you a snow day.
If they do, right. If they do. So, well, that's great. That's great. So everybody's good health. Everything's going well.
Yep.
Good.
Everything's on track.
Yeah, they're keeping you awake, though, huh?
Oh, man, I'm so tired today.
Need to get more sleep. Those kids are kicking your butt, huh?
Oh, man, it's just tons of, like, wrestling and getting kicked and punched in the face.
They're at that age, though, right? They're at that age where they're
yeah,
into that.
That huh? Yeah. So. We got a bounce house in the basement that we throw up.
Uh-huh.
And that helps get some of that that aggression, that energy, especially, like, when it's cold out.
Gotcha.
So you don't have to put them in their snowsuits and all this other stuff.
Gotcha. Well,
it's a pro move.
Yeah, get them tired, and then they go down, and then they're asleep, right?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, things over here have been pretty normal. Lately, my daughter's been into the potty and wanting to go into the bathroom and do her business. So we've just been, we put the potty in the bathroom, but she's still pretty young. But today, she actually went in the potty. Now, I think it's just was a fluke, but when she says it, we're like, we might as well put her on it and go with it. No stress.
Yeah.
We're not pressuring it.
Yeah,
it's just going after it. So, but she did. She peed in it today, and yay. So when she listens back to this in 16 years, she'll hear about her first time that she peed in the potty. So
yeah. Yay.
She'll be excited, but we were all proud of her today. So
memories.
Awesome deal. So, well, today we've got a really, really exciting episode. Exciting in the fact that we brought on some folks to I really wanted to get back. My daughter, before she was born, she was diagnosed with a complete AVSD, and just recently had it repaired at Mott Hospital at U of M. And because it's Heart Awareness Month this month, I reached out to some of our surgeons over at U of M, and we got in touch with another surgeon from U of M, and we're really excited to have him on and kind of tell us a little bit about Heart Awareness Month and the different things that you do at Mott, and just kind of just give us some more information and raise some awareness. So today we have assistant professor of cardiac surgery Michigan Medicine at CS Mott Children's Hospital. We have Dr. Ming Sing C. So welcome, Dr. C, to the DAD Experience. We're really excited to have you here today.
Oh, thank you very much, guys. Happy to be here.
So we like to start our show off just kind of with guests just telling us a little bit about you and your family and, you know, who you live with at home.
Yeah, so I have a lovely wife and three boys.
All right.
They are ages 6 years, 4 years, and 11 months.
Oh, wow.
So, nice.
Wow. So you're busy. So, you're a busy dad over
yeah.
there.
Yeah. Well, my wife's probably busier, so.
Yeah. Well, you know, you're managing the home schedule, and I'm sure all the stuff that you have to do with the hospital and being a doctor. So, I mean, I'm sure you're all very, very busy. Now, does your wife work full-time, too, or?
No, she doesn't. She's full time at home, so that's, she takes care of them. That's probably
three kids. That's more than
that's
a huge job. That's a huge job. I'll tell you, it's a very, very big job. So, well, that's great. That's really cool to hear. So, you are a surgeon at U of M for cardiac. I said right. That's what we got the right title. So I got the right title correct of everything. So tell us a little bit about. You know, I think I told you a little bit, but my daughter had a complete AVSD. And can you tell us about congenital heart, you know, defects? And I read somewhere, I think it said that it's the number one birth defect for children. So could you kind of tell us a little bit about it and how it affects children? And
yeah,
start there?
It is like you mentioned, it is the most common type of birth defect in this nation as well as in the world.
Oh, wow.
And so there is an incredible burden of congenital heart disease worldwide. Many children are affected. Congenital heart disease come in many different flavors, many different severities. Mm-hmm. And it's estimated that about anywhere between 5 to 8 children per 100,000 births will require some sort of intervention, either surgery or cardiac catheterization procedure to deal with their critical congenital heart disease at birth. And there are probably many others who won't need anything initially, but may need some sort of intervention as they grow up, to even when they're adults.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Yeah.
Congenital heart disease is something that if you have it, you live with it for the rest of your life. Some of the simple defects we can render a so-called cure in terms of surgical mm-hmm. repair, mm-hmm. but there are other types of defects where one can say we might palliate them. We can make them better, give them a normal childhood, but they will need to come back periodically mm-hmm. for repeat interventions or repeat surgeries, and that can mm-hmm. last through adulthood.
Right. But with modern technology, and I'm just curious, with modern technology and everything advances in medicine, are they expecting that, you know, these children are living much, you know, longer lives? Or is it still too soon to really know how long with the ever-changing technology? Do we even know if they're going to, you know, how long?
Yeah. I think in the past two generations, we have seen an incredible advancement in the treatment of congenital heart disease. Mm-hmm. And that is with the advent of cardiac surgery, being able to stop the heart, maintain the rest of the body, do the repair on the heart and restart the heart, and have the patient survive that kind of procedure. That technology probably was developed in the, I would say, 1950s, 1960s. Mm-hmm. And we've come a long ways. There were some cardiac defects, some heart defects that we thought were basically uncurable or untreatable a decade ago or 15 years ago, and certainly that's not the case now. Mm-hmm. So technology is certainly improving, but and we're able to address a lot of these critical congenital heart defects, mm-hmm. But there's still a lot of improvement that need to be made.
Right.
You know, maybe a decade ago or 20 years ago, we were thinking about survival, getting children to survive these complex surgeries. Now that they're surviving, we mm-hmm. want to look at their long-term outcomes, their mm-hmm. quality of life. So a lot of these, as technology, as our ability to get these kids through the operation improves, there are many other things that we have to look at
right.
because they have a long life to live ahead of them.
Right. Yeah, and I just, you know, I know firsthand, and obviously we're just starting our journey. We just had our daughter just had surgery in June of 2017, which was a complete AVSD repair. And, I mean, right now she's doing great. I mean, she has overcome quite a few obstacles, and it's amazing to see how it didn't seem to phase her. Like, even before, for her, we were lucky that she was born in October of 2016, and we didn't have the surgery until June in 2017. So it was crazy to see. We didn't really notice like the symptoms and all those good things. And we just decided to then, once we started to hear it a little bit more, the doctor started to hear it a little bit more, we then decided to do it in June. So it's crazy, you know, just to think that they can do this. So how do people find out if their child has some sort of heart defect or heart disease?
Yeah, that's a good question. I mean, nowadays, with improvements in prenatal ultrasound, many times that can be identified even mm-hmm. before, you know, children are born. But then there are, you know, in terms of diagnosing it or how it presents after babies are born, it depends on the severity of the heart disease. Mm-hmm. If it's a severe heart disease, then it will definitely present within the first few weeks mm-hmm. of life. Mm-hmm. Babies will present with trouble feeding. They're not gaining weight. They have rapid breathing. And they just look ill. Mm-hmm. And those fortunately those situations are rare because we can usually detect critical congenital heart disease prenatally. So we're prepared. Mm-hmm. So we know what to expect. We don't let these children go home. but some of them do slip through. Mm-hmm. And or there are some patients who don't have access to that kind of care. And so they present afterwards. And then there's other types of congenital heart defects that really are asymptomatic. And they can be asymptomatic for many years. Mm-hmm. And then present when they're in school, when they're entering school, or even when they're teenagers. Mm-hmm. So, and I, you know, I even operate on adults who present that late because mm-hmm. they didn't know for their entire lives that they had a congenital heart defect. And they may present when they're 20, 30, 40, 50 mm-hmm. years old.
Mm-hmm. So is there something that we can do for our children to just like a pre-screen, or is it recommended that we say, hey, or do our pediatricians check, or how does that normally, I mean, I know that, like you said, they can slip through the cracks, and normally, like in our case, they did detect it at the anatomy scan way early on in one of the ultrasounds. But let's say that doesn't happen. Is it something that, I mean, more than likely, I'm assuming people are going to be in the clear, but is it something that pediatricians are looking for, or, you know, is there a lot of awareness out there for our pediatricians out there?
You're asking if there's like screenings that,
yeah, like that a screening, or
I think there's a heart defect screen that you have to go through,
but
like when you're,
well,
you know, all in, at least in the state of Michigan, and mm-hmm. I think most states, the United States, newborns have to pass this oxygen saturation mm-hmm. Test.
Right.
They need to get their oxygen saturations measured. Mm-hmm. It's a very, very simple test. It's a non-invasive test. Mm-hmm. And if their oxygen saturations are normal, then it's unlikely that they have congenital heart disease and they get discharged home.
Mm-hmm.
So that helps us catch some of those critical ones that maybe they may look fine within the first week of life, and we might be able to catch those before they get discharged home. In terms of, you know, some of these, I mentioned these heart defects, which may be asymptomatic.
Right.
I mean, fortunately, those are not, I should say, the heart and the body is able to tolerate the defect. It can tolerate the physiology that that defect creates for some time without any irreversible harm. But with careful physical examination by the pediatrician, some of those can, well, a lot of those can be detected by, for instance, a heart murmur. And that will trigger more detailed tests like an ultrasound of the heart, like an echocardiogram, electrocardiogram, chest x-ray, and then we can nail down the precise defect.
Right. So.
And so that's.
Go ahead.
Sorry. So some of the patients that come to us when they're older, that's usually the story that we hear. That's that they're completely asymptomatic, and they go into their doctor for the physical, and a heart murmur is detected.
Okay.
And then that. That's how we identify it.
So our children, like say we have children, let's say they it goes undetected for a while. More than likely it would be something that would be picked up if it was later in life on some sort of yearly physical when they're checking the heart and listening for those things that they're usually checking for, things like that?
Yes, okay. Usually, yes, that's okay. Correct.
Okay. Well, that's why I was curious, because I know I'm listening to you and I'm going, oh gosh, there's probably a lot of dads out there listening, you know, or going to be listening and going, wait a minute. So I'd be going to get him a test.
I got to have my kids screened.
So that's why I wanted to ask, because I'm like, so if we're going for, but that's why I think, you know, and I don't think, especially as we get older, I know that I'm a really bad example of this, but why I think that yearly physicals are that important. I think sometimes we don't think about those things. So if people wanted to do more, get more involved, what kind of things, I know that it's Heart Awareness Month. So what kind of things are you guys doing at U of M, or are you involved in that, for Heart Awareness Month to help out in, you know, raising awareness about congenital heart defects or just the heart in general?
Right. So as you may have heard, you know, February is the official Heart Month.
Right.
So our center, University of Michigan Congenital Heart Center, has chosen, you know, this week for to be the kind of the Congenital Heart Awareness Week. Wanted to bring awareness to the public and our patients,
right,
of the importance of congenital heart disease in general. You know, that it's the most common type of birth defect, and that in some instances may require some of these complex interventions,
right,
whether it be surgery or some sort of cardiac catheterization procedure. So I mean, I think the purpose of this is manifold. There's education, awareness. There's helping advance innovations in clinical care, as well as the research into congenital heart disease, understanding why they occur, understanding kind of the genetic basis behind it, or the development of new therapies for some of these patients with congenital heart disease. So I know our center has multiple efforts on those fronts, and you know, their website umsaveaheart.org kind of goes into that in a little more detail. And in a sense, there is a fundraising campaign, but it's not really the, you know, focal point of that website.
Right.
It's to bring awareness to congenital heart disease.
Right.
Dr. C, you mentioned the research and interventions. Is there something like an intervention or a treatment that would if it were invented or being researched right now, is there like one specific treatment or intervention that would help eliminate like the majority of these heart defects, or is it just like it's a case by case, you know, like every individual is different?
So, you know, the latter is probably correct. It's a case by case thing. Well, it all boils down to what causes congenital heart disease. It's, mm-hmm. it's something in the development of the heart or the cardiovascular system, blood vessels kind of went awry. And it's, you know, the heart is the first organ to develop in the body, in the embryo. It's very, very complex. So there are many, many, many steps. If one of those things goes awry, it can cause a heart defect. There is some sort of genetic basis to congenital heart disease, but it's not a one that is, I should say that it's a simple correlation to a genetic problem. It's not like every patient that has a particular heart defect has a well-defined genetic defect. That's certainly not the case. So you could have unidentified genetic problems that can cause heart defects. Many of them are not defined at all or are not associated with any known genetic defects. All we can say is that if you have a child that has a congenital heart defect, it's more likely that a sibling will have it. It's not 100%. Mm-hmm. Okay.
But the chances are increased.
The chances are increased versus the normal population. That's correct. So in terms of, you know, getting back to your question about treatment, you know, I can talk about the research that I'm doing as I'm most familiar with that. So I also run the heart transplant program, the surgical director for the pediatric heart transplant program at Mont. So I treat children with a very severe heart failure. Mm-hmm. And a lot of those children have heart failure secondary to advanced congenital heart disease. Okay, so they might have it. So they have a defect in their heart. The heart's not working efficiently, or it's working overtime and eventually gets tired and it fails. But there are many other reasons for heart failure. You can have a disorder in the heart muscle itself, leading to a weak heart muscle, and then these children may develop a severe heart failure and require a heart transplant. As you may imagine, you know, heart transplant is not very common, and certainly very uncommon in children because of the lack of donors. So, so these patients will have to wait a substantial amount of time to receive a suitable donor organ, and we have to get those patients through and support them while they're waiting. So new medications, I know my colleagues in cardiology are looking at, are participating in trials of new medications to help support the heart. I'm interested in regenerative medicine therapies to support the failing heart, like stem cell therapy or tissue engineering. And we hope to have a clinical trial going within the next year or so of stem cell therapy for certain patients with congenital heart disease.
Cool.
And then there's, you know, borrowing from experience in adult patients with heart failure, where you have mechanical devices like total artificial heart or ventricular assist devices. And those devices are certainly very basic and definitely need a lot more advances and innovations in that realm to get better outcomes in these patients with heart failure. So I can speak to this heart failure segment of our patients, and there's certainly a lot that we're doing right now to get their care better, to improve their care and their outcomes.
So you mentioned a little bit about devices that are being used now. Have there been any other successes with things that are being used, let it be maybe animals or things like that? Has there been anything in advancements in that, or no, we're still pretty much with what, you know, you were talking about, whether it's mechanical now and, or, you know, just repairing?
Yeah.
How are we with that?
Yeah, I mean, our mainstay is, you know, for congenital heart disease is to attempt repairs and mm-hmm. to palliate things. We try to do that. I think that in the long run is still better than transplanting, because that comes with its whole set of other problems and mm-hmm. issues. But if patients have no other choice and we've kind of gotten the most out of their heart, mm-hmm. it's time to transplant, then we start looking at the possibility of needing to support them with a mechanical device.
Okay.
If they can't wait long enough to receive that heart. The challenges for children with heart failure and mechanical devices really stems from the devices that are available. They're developed by companies. And for the most part, a lot of these devices are borrowed from what has been developed for adults.
Mm-hmm.
And there are a lot of technical challenges of bringing these devices into children. Certainly, they can be too large, right. for instance, for an infant. Yes, that's correct. So, and you can't just like scale it down,
right?
Make that smaller. And the other challenge, you know, for the companies is that the number of children with heart failure certainly is a lot smaller than adults with heart right. failure. So for them to develop a device for adults, it's certainly a larger market.
Right.
And for as a business decision, it makes yeah. sense to develop mm-hmm. for children and have it undergo extensive testing and FDA approval,
right.
which is very protracted and complicated and expensive.
Mm-hmm.
There's really no incentive. Gotcha. So I kind of feel like this segment of population is really underserved, unfortunately.
Mm-hmm.
Just because of the pure logistical barriers that come into play with trying to create a device
yeah.
for like these tiny little, you know, fragile bodies.
Hmm.
Yeah, it's difficult from an engineering perspective.
Yeah.
It's difficult from a business perspective.
Yeah.
It's difficult from a regulatory perspective.
Right.
So there are a right. lot of challenges, but, you know, for us who treat these patients on the front line, including myself and my colleagues at other institutions, you know, we feel very passionate. So we're trying to push this area of investigation forward.
Right. So there's stuff that's going on, and I'm assuming that's kind of what sometimes some of these the awareness months would, I'm hoping that would help do raise funds for things like that to help with research. Yes or no?
Yes.
Is that yeah?
Yes.
Okay. That's yes, great. That's good to know.
Yeah, I mean, raise awareness for something that's, you know, definitely sounds like it, you know,
it's needed.
It's needed. Just because it doesn't make money doesn't mean it doesn't.
Yeah, that's
we don't need it.
But that's a different discussion there. Even I mean, I was cost effective comes up a lot in medicine and blows my mind because I just don't understand. But that's just me. But yeah, it's well, we appreciate all the work that's going into that though, and I know that you guys at U of M are doing a lot to push that things like that forward. I had another question too, kind of with what you said. So you said that, you know, siblings could be at a higher risk if one had already presented a congenital heart defect. Does it usually go hand in hand with some sort of other genetic anomaly, or is it just a lot of times just the one? Or how does that work?
Yeah.
Do you see that case presented a lot? Or
yeah, most congenital heart defects, when they present, is not associated with a known genetic anomaly.
Okay.
Usually that's not. So unless there's a known genetic syndrome
mm-hmm.
that runs in the family,
mm-hmm.
And then in certain cases, there are also known genetic syndromes that may happen spontaneously that are strongly associated with congenital heart disease, like trisomy 21.
Mm-hmm.
In general, it's not. And, you know, the genetic piece to it is a lot more complex than we know right now.
Okay. That's
So even though a sibling that has a child with a congenital heart defect, their siblings are more than they have a higher chance of having a congenital heart defect themselves, but it's not attributed to the genetics, or is
Well, it is. It must be attributed to genetics, but we don't. It's undefined. We don't know why. We can't identify a specific gene in most cases. I would say majority, 99% of cases, we can't identify a specific gene. And I say the risk is increased versus the normal population, but it's still going to be very uncommon.
I got you. That's what I was going to ask next. That's what I was assuming, that it's still very uncommon. You're just at a higher risk of it. And, and you know, I knew that going in because of what my daughter's been going through. And it, obviously we did, you know, when they found out that our first child did have, you know, the complete ABSD, that they did all those tests. But for us, as of right now, everything is, you know, normal and
good
for her. And so that's what I, but I was curious if there was anything that goes hand in hand and things to look out for folks that maybe have gone through this and say maybe something still hasn't presented itself, but it's not necessarily the case. They could just have this one genetic issue and then there wouldn't be anything else. So, and then what's the, do they know from, or do you know from studies, what's the likelihood now that, let's say it's never been in somebody's family before and somebody's had it. And does that now create that within the family, or could it be just a one-time thing that happened because it's not been carried down or it's not been heard of in a family? How does that work?
Well, if so, if you have a congenital heart disease, your children might have an increased risk again. But and like I say, in most cases, it's not well defined or not defined at all.
Right.
With in terms of the known genetic mutations or something like that. Most times it's undefined. I guess one could speculate that that it's unlikely to present in future generations. But if there is a history, there's probably a slightly increased risk.
Right, exactly. Yeah. I was just curious what that was. So yeah, I mean it's a crazy thing that I'd never experienced before, and so if people wanted to get involved, can you tell us again the website that they can go to maybe get a little more information? And I'm assuming on that website you guys do have a lot of information about stats and things too, or is it just
So the website umsaveaheart.org just lists our, you know, our efforts for Heart Awareness Week, and some of the if you choose to donate to this cause, what those funds are being used for. And in our CS Mott Children's website, the Congenital Heart Center website, we have a lot more detail on the individual defects, the statistics, epidemiology behind them. I don't know the website off the top of my head, but
I'll link it into the show notes. I'll look it up and find it and put a direct link to it. But okay. Yeah, so to get some more of the statistical information, they get it from the heart website from the hospital. But the other website you're speaking of is talking about raising awareness and where the people can make a donation. So let's, you know, if there's other parents out there or that are listening, what are things for parents to watch for if their child does have some sort of heart defect? Do they need to become helicopter parents? I'm using that term lightly because I don't think that's the case, but I'm saying, do they need to become more protective of their children, or do they need to just kind of let them be children and grow up to be adults?
Yeah. I mean, that's a very good question. For the most part, we want our patients, children who have congenital heart disease and undergo procedures or surveillance and watch, we want them to have a normal childhood. That is part of normal development. You know, it's required. There are some patients with their congenital heart defects, they may be more susceptible to, or I should say, if they were to get a upper respiratory infection, it would be more severe. So we would counsel families to obviously avoid sick contacts and mm-hmm. frequent hand washing and right. those sort of things. But we certainly don't want these children to be living in bubbles.
Right.
We want them to have a normal upbringing and experiences.
Mm-hmm. So don't be precautionary.
Yes.
And
yes.
aware. Yes.
Mm-hmm. You know, is there, I'm trying to think, is there symptoms that may, or will the child know when they're old enough, obviously, that, hey, you know, something's not right, or I can't do this? Will they just put self-limitations usually on them? Is that kind of like the case, or is that, you know, are they kids going to be kids and just try and do whatever they can anyways? Or is it?
Yeah, I mean, if the child has known congenital heart disease and mm-hmm. it's being followed,
right?
Actually, their amount of activity relative to themselves at a certain point in time, or relative to their friends, their peers, mm-hmm. is actually a good way to assess how much their heart disease is affecting them.
Mm-hmm.
So if they're not able to keep up with their friends, mm-hmm. or, you know, compared to last year, they're not able to do as much, or they feel more tired, you know, that those are important signs to suggest further testing to mm-hmm. see what the status of their heart is.
Mm-hmm.
so, I mean, we would use that as an important piece of information.
Gotcha. And, you know, I know that we're seeing, and it might be more because the internet is so accessible by everybody now, but we're seeing, you know, I've heard more cases and read more stories about, you know, a lot of the athletics and whether or not it be in schools or outside of schools or traveling teams or whatever. You're seeing more and more things pop up with heart issues. Are they doing more that you know of within, or trying to push more that you know of just being aware and watching the kids, or putting it on the radar of maybe schools or coaches or things like that? You know, because I think I've heard a little bit more, and again, it might be just because the internet is becoming more, but
yeah.
But is there kind of anything out there that they can do or can be aware of?
Yes. You know, my impression is that that parents, that schools, athletic teams and schools are more aware okay. of congenital heart mm-hmm. disease. Mm-hmm. Or I should say, not necessarily congenital heart disease, of heart disease
right.
that can be serious and affect especially athletes.
Mm-hmm.
I think what they're specifically referring to are this what we call hypertrophic obstructive cardiomyopathy. Mm-hmm. So there's a disorder of the muscle in the heart. There's not necessarily a missing right. or malformed structure in the heart. Right, it's just right. the muscle's very thick. So mm-hmm. you can say it's a type of congenital heart disease, but it's not the one that we classically see right. At a younger age. But those patients, and they can be certainly very healthy, very athletic,
mm-hmm.
but under conditions of intense competition and exercise, that's stress when that. Yeah, that heart problem can cause sudden death.
Mm-hmm.
So, and we've seen that in competitive athletics in school mm-hmm. age children, as well as professional athletes
right.
and adults.
Yeah.
So I think more people are aware of it. Now, how do we address that? I think the jury's still out on mm-hmm. and how we do this and how we prevent this from happening.
Mm-hmm.
I know certain groups have advocated screening with EKGs mm-hmm. and maybe echocardiograms, but it is a very uncommon problem.
Right.
So these screening tests may not be as the screen tests that are available now may not be the most optimal, you mm-hmm. know? So I think the requires that area requires more investigation to come up with a better screening test mm-hmm. or screening algorithm. But I think if families are more aware, pediatricians are more aware, and these the schools are more aware, mm-hmm. those should be able to be picked up sooner before they are discovered, you know, on the field,
right,
so
and
to speak.
And so. hopefully down the road here soon, you know, we've been seeing a lot with a big push for obviously concussion awareness and having
yeah.
people train. So hopefully down the road we'll see more with something with heart and knowing. Watch for signs or things like that, or to help, you know, people, like you said, have some sort of a screener for them, you know, before they get involved in something. So hopefully something like that will come about in the near future, and you know, we'll see less of that as well. So it's a good thing. I do know that they've been putting a lot more of, you know, heart awareness within schools where I'm at. You know, you mm-hmm. see things by law that they have to put into schools now. So hopefully that's around the corner. So before we take our break, Dr. C, is there anything that we may have missed or you want to let our listeners know about congenital heart defects?
You know, one thing that we can discuss or mention is that in congenital heart disease, it's characterized by a malformation of one or more structures in the heart. It can be a malformation that is kind of a misshapen structure.
Mm-hmm.
It can be a malformation in which the structure is entirely missing.
Sure.
And so that's the challenge with repairs of congenital heart defects, because sometimes we have to use, because if it's missing, we have to use something to replace that part.
Mm-hmm.
And replacing those parts in a child that needs to grow is very challenging. And that's the reason why these kids who require surgery early in life may need to come back later mm-hmm. in life, because they're outgrowing that particular patch or valve,
mm-hmm.
For instance, and we require replacement of that through their entire lifetime.
Right,
Dr. C, is there? Uh-huh. I'm just Star Trekking this up uh-huh. here, but like, you know, 3D printers. Is there like a biological 3D printable material that they can
oh, yeah.
grow cells on?
Yeah.
Like
so
print
I
out
can,
a valve that's
so that,
small?
Yeah. So I can talk a lot about that, because that's one of the areas of research we have in our laboratory. So I think what you're getting at is creating organs or tissues in the laboratory for use in patients.
Right. Or something like you can print out the framework and then you can graft, you know,
yeah.
cells or stem, I don't know what would grow onto a grass, some kind of
right.
cell, I would
right.
assume. And
right.
then
no.
grow from there.
Right. No, that's exactly kind of the most common type of strategy that people are using right now. But if you take, for instance, the heart or any organ in the body, it's a substantial size, okay? And it's doing a lot of work. It has a function to it.
It's moving all the time.
Yeah, for the heart, it's moving all the time. It's using a lot of oxygen. It's using a lot of energy. Our own heart and organs and tissues are wonderful because they have a very complex plumbing to it to bring all those nutrients. I'm just talking about blood vessels. And that's a problem with engineered or tissue-engineered organs right now. We can, you know, with the advent of the special we call induced pluripotent stem cells, we can make any cell type we want, as many as we want. The problem is when we put them together, if you try to make a, for instance, heart muscle of a centimeter thick, which is normal heart muscle thickness in an adult, it will not stay a centimeter thick because what's in the center doesn't get the oxygen from the environment. So that core will die off. So you'll only be able to generate very thin engineer tissues, which is not really of use to patients because it doesn't really, it doesn't supply much work. You know, a very thin piece of muscle is not going to contract very forcefully versus a centimeter thick. So one of the challenges is creating this complex blood vessel network in these engineered tissues. So that's one major obstacle to the field, the whole field of tissue engineering. Now, you mentioned 3D bioprinters because we actually just recently acquired one and using that in a research in our lab. And that, I think, is a game changer. Certainly, we still have to do a lot more research to get to the point of creating, for instance, a heart or heart muscle that has the blood vessels within it that can be implanted to a patient and provide enough force to help the heart pump blood, okay? And so you mentioned about printing scaffolds and then seeding cells. 3D bioprinters, you're able to actually even print cells. Cells are used as the ink. And so you can print cells along with the scaffolds in a you know, certain pattern.
Nice.
So the major limitation to bioprinters right now, 3D bioprinters, is the resolution. the resolution at which you can print a cell or print the scaffold. They just don't have that accuracy or precision there. And the other thing to realize is that if you're using, for instance, cells as an ink, the cells themselves have a particular specific shape in the tissue. So the printer can't print a cell with a specific shape and just deposit the cell in a general location and let the cell do its work. So it's not going to be the answer, but I think it'll get us a step closer to creating heart tissue and valves.
The different techniques and...
Yeah, one day you'd be used in patients. Right. And if you can create something living like that, then, you know, what I mentioned about one of the kind of the Achilles heel of congenital heart surgery, you might be able to create a living part that you can put in and use, and that will grow with the patient. You know, that would be kind of the holy grail, I would say.
Wow, I continue to be amazed by the things you guys are doing over there at Mott Hospital. So we're going to take a quick break, and when we come back, we're going to do things a little bit different. Dr. C would like to talk about some of the things that he did as a child or an older child that he'd like to share with his children as they get older and as they grow. So stick around after the break and hear what he has to say about all those different activities. Welcome back to the Dad Experience. So we normally ask about the three movies you'd like to share with your children, but Dr. C had a little bit of a different take on it, and not going out or seeing as many movies, he decided to tell us about some activities that he'd like to share with his children. So Dr. C, what is it that you are most excited to share with your children?
Well, I would say, you know, if there's one thing that I would really like to, that I enjoyed as a child or as an older child, mm-hmm. that I would like to take my kids or have my kids experiences, you know, actually like hiking or camping. Okay. I don't really get to do that anymore here.
But yeah, nice. That's important.
I grew up in California. It was more frequent back then, you know, when I was living there. but that's kind of the thing that I hope to, you know, show them. And I've always really enjoyed the nature and scenery, and I hope to show them as well.
So that's a good segue. So
Michigan's a great place for it.
It is a great place for it.
Summertime, yeah.
Summertime.
Yes,
summertime.
Hey, snowshoeing's fun too.
Yeah.
Cross-country skiing is fun.
Cross-country skiing, yeah.
With all those good things. So we'll do it. We've done a new that you've shifted our thought here, and you've told us the activity you're most excited to share with your children, and that's really
cool. I like it.
You know, I thinking back to my childhood, those are some of the fun memories too. So,
Boy Scouts,
Boy Scouts, and doing all that good stuff. So I think that's awesome that that's something you're really excited to share with your children. So thank you so much for being here with us today. You know, it's been an honor to have you on our show. And
yeah, thanks, Dr. C.
I wanted to
my pleasure.
I especially wanted to do something that means a lot to my family, and I'd seen it going around a little bit that this was Heart Month, obviously, and I wanted to do something to give back. So thank you for doing this, and you know, all of you guys at U of M, we've been in great hands, and I can't say that enough. And I'll be honest with you, I'm a state grad, so it's hard for me sometimes to say that. But you know what? I wouldn't trade any of it.
Hey, when you're fighting for kids, man, everybody's on the same side.
And I would never ever trade any of our experience in. I mean, it was great. We were blessed to be there and to have amazing, you know, doctors on our side. So thank you for what you do, and thank you for taking your time out. I know you're really busy and have a family that you want to be with, so we won't keep you hopefully too much longer, and just thanks so much for being here today.
Oh, my pleasure. Thanks. My pleasure.
Well, Mike,
thanks, Dr. C.
Yeah, thanks. And Mike, it's always great seeing you, and thanks for being here with me today as well.
Hey, no problem, man.
The Dad Experience can be found on the Apple Podcast app, the Google Play Store, Stitcher, and many other podcast databases. The Dad Experience is also a proud member of the Parents On Demand Network. Download the Parents On Demand Network app, and you can find this episode as well as all of our past episodes. You can also find many other great parenting podcasts. Stay tuned after this episode to hear about another great podcast that we at the Dad Experience think you will enjoy. Have a show idea? Have a comment about one of our past episodes or a question for one of our guests? Make sure you tweet at us at DadExpPodcast or email us at experienceanddad@gmail.com. You can also find us on Facebook at The Dad Experience. Thanks so much for listening, and we'll see you next time on The Dad Experience.
The Dad Experience.